call my talk this evening of men, mountains and trees. I've taken that from an old Zen saying, which I think most of you have probably heard. It says, when you start out on this way, men are men, mountains are mountains and trees are trees. When you've gone some good way along the path, you find there are no men, there are no mountains, and there are no trees. However, when you come to the end, then, once again, men are men, mountains are mountains, and trees are trees, but no one is confused by the terms. And I wonder if I can to give you what one could call the background behind that little saying. It's pointing to both the analytical method and the synthetical method of Buddhism. Now that sounds horribly complicated, but in point of fact it's something that we all employ normally and naturally, although maybe not as precisely as perhaps we could. We all recognize, I think, that there are different ways of saying things. Buddhism recognizes two levels of truth, conventional and ultimate. And these two truths lie behind the saying, that Zen saying about men, mountains and trees. You might ask, how is it possible that there's more than one kind of truth? Surely truth is truth, and that's that. Well, it's not really that easy. It's not that simple. For example, one of the stories used to illustrate this I can take directly from the canon. There was a monk who wished to oil his skin, and he asked his attendant junior monk for the oil tube. The young monk said, "Oh, but it's got no oil in it, venerable sir." The old monk said, "Oh, well, never mind." Then he said, "I'll use it to store this powder in." And the young monk turned back and said, "Oh, but it's got oil in it, venerable sir." He said, "Well, make up your mind, which is it?" And yet, of course, both statements were absolutely true. It didn't have enough oil in it for one purpose, but it had a film of oil all around it, which would have prevented the use to which the old monk wished to put it. So both statements were true, and yet they seem to be totally opposed. Truth is entirely relative. It depends totally upon context. There is no such thing, then, as absolute truth. It's a complete mixture of terms. As I said, Buddhism recognizes two levels of truth, conventional and ultimate. To try and give you an idea of what conventional truth actually means, I hope to expand upon it a little bit. For example, we make the general statement, quite rightly, that all human beings have two arms, two legs, and so on. And I don't think anyone really would quarrel with that. It's a generalization, a conventional truth, which we all recognize. However, it's manifestly untrue in certain instances. Some people have lost limbs through accident, through war perhaps. They may be born with a congenital defect. In short, the statement all human beings have two arms and two legs is not true, and yet we recognize it as true, conventionally speaking. Similarly, we might say that all human beings have the ability to think rationally at some level. We might even say that that is what defines their humanity. And yet, manifestly, that is not true in every instance. There are such things as mentally retarded people, mentally retarded children, who clearly do not have the capacity to think rationally. Some older people suffer from senile dementia, where they seem to lose the capacity to think rationally in the way we normally mean that term. So the statement isn't true, and yet we recognize it as being true on the conventional level. What we do then is take a whole number of different experiences, different instances where we see human beings with two arms and two legs, and we see so many people like that, we come to the conclusion, we come to the generalization, we come to the conventional truth that all human beings have two arms and two legs. Well, that's fine, up to a point. But if we then stick rigidly by that and regard that as totally, indeed one might almost say absolutely true, then we have forged for ourselves a bond and a fetter to the mind. And that fetter, that bond, will not allow us to see clearly people who do not have two arms and two legs. That's perhaps rather a crude example, but there is a case on record where a person saw a rhinoceros for the first time and said, oh, it doesn't exist, there's no such animal. There it was, standing in front of him. That sounds funny. It might even sound pathetic. But this is the sort of trick the mind can get up to. We synthesize a conventional truth based on lots of different individual experiences. We tend then to treat that as a law, which is always true. That generalization is, however, always inaccurate. That is the very nature of conventional truth. People realizing this have spent lifetimes in the search for truth, for accuracy, if you like. The search for truth or search for accuracy goes in quite the other direction. It goes from the general statement to the particular. In other words, what we have to do is analyze our experience to try and see just how true a particular generalization or law actually is. How true is conventional truth? Already then we begin to question the absoluteness of any truth we might act by, and we begin to investigate our world much more closely. As a for instance, conventionally we say the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, it traverses the sky usually towards the south. As of course you're in the southern hemisphere, then it's to the north. So we say the sun rises and sets. It's obvious then from that observation that the sun goes round the earth, and in earlier times that was thought to be the case. This was truth, no question about it. And yet various people with inquiring minds analyze precisely what was taking place by reference to stars and other planets and so on, and came to the more accurate conclusion that the earth actually goes round the sun, rotating as it does so. Does it surprise you to realize that those people stood in severe danger of being branded as heretics? They had upset the conventional truth of the day. They had replaced it, at least in their own minds, with a truth more accurate, an analytical truth, if you like. From each point of view, those statements are correct. In other words, the earth does definitely go round the sun. That's the generally accepted view today. Equally though, from our own individual personal experience, it appears as though, and we can act as though, the sun goes round the earth. So the statements are both true. It depends very much upon the level at which the discussion is taking place. And that level is critical. And that's where we come back to the conventional truth and the ultimate truth of Buddhism. They are two quite distinct levels and shouldn't be mixed. Before I get into that in detail, let's just think how the search for truth, in broad terms, has developed. Taking Western experience, It started, I suppose you could say, with the Greeks, who began to analyze the objective world, and it's gone on since that time, starting with people like Heraclitus, Archimedes, Pythagoras, and so on, and worked up through the centuries until we get the Einsteins and so forth of modern times. Always the accent has been on looking at the world to see how it functions, looking at the objective universe around us, from the very large, the suns, the planets, and so on, to the very small. And it's become fairly well established that there are such things as atoms and subatomic particles with some delightful names like charms and quarks and things like that. There's all kinds of discrete bits then into which what we would normally see as a mountain or a man or a tree has been broken down. Has been broken down into these subatomic particles, and we can truly say at that level of truth that men don't exist, mountains don't exist, and trees don't exist. It's a truth which is, if you like, more refined than the generalization which we habitually use. However, the development of scientific truth in the West certainly doesn't stop there, and there was a man called Heisenberg who put forward what is called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of science, but essentially what it states is that if you consider an atom, you can either know where it is or how fast it's going, but not both. In other words, you can only be aware of one of those things at a time. So in short, if you know how fast it's travelling, you have no idea where it is. And if you know where it is, you have no idea how fast it's travelling. And in fact, it goes slightly beyond that, to the point that you don't even know how big it is, or what area or volume of space it occupies. In short, it becomes rather doubtful as to whether it really exists. One is uncertain as to precisely what is there. In other words, that solid chunk of subatomic particle has somehow sort of vanished. It's gone. It turned out to be nothing more than an idea, a concept, a conventional truth. In short, all of Western science is conventional truth. It does not deal with realities. It only deals with ideas, interpretations, and views. Now that sounds like a terrible indictment of science, and indeed we all know how useful it is, so one has to keep it in perspective. But as a means of searching for the ultimate truth, we have to say that it's failed. The East, you see, took quite a different tack. They've always known about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. They've known about it for thousands of years. They've known what Heisenberg came to discover, and that is that the observer has an effect on what he observes. In other words, the experimenter and his experiment affect one another. They're inseparably connected. And so you can't deal with an objective universe out there untouched by human mind or hand. It's all interdependent. Oriental wisdom has known this for thousands of years, and so they didn't fall into the same trap that Western science has done, particularly since the so-called Enlightenment of the Middle Ages, after the Middle Ages. They realized that individual experience is really the only measure of truth, the only measure, if you like, of reality. The question then arises, a rather important one, what is real experience? What is real experience? is it what we say we experience, or is that just simply an interpretation? Or is it something more fundamental? What is ultimate truth, in short, and how might we get at it, assuming such a thing to exist? Certainly we're not going to do it through microscopes and telescopes. We're not going to do it through any kind of scientific instruments. We have only ourselves upon whom to rely. The senses we've got, the equipment we have with here right now, this very evening, the equipment we always have, the six senses. There's nothing else. Okay, so the investigator, the experimenter, if you like, starts out on his search for ultimate truth using only the tools that he has as a human being, his six senses. What does he find out? Pretty soon he discovers for himself, and indeed that's the only way this can be discovered, he discovers for himself that you can only experience one thing at a time. So already he's caught up with Heisenberg, who found the same thing, only it took science about 2,000 years to get to that same point. The meditator can do it slightly more quickly. He discovers that the sense fields do not overlap in any way. You can't see what you touch. You can't touch what you see. You can't smell what you hear. You can't hear what you smell. And this is not something that's open really to argument or discussion. This is a fact which any person, any individual, can prove for himself or for herself simply by the meditative process. One can look at a table, a man, a mountain, a tree. What is the experience? The experience is of a visible object, no more. And bear in mind that as you can only do one thing at a time, the seeing is not the same as the touching. The touching comes at a different point in time, if you like, is a different experience, is not related directly to the seeing. So one can touch a table or a mountain or a tree, but that's not seeing. The experience of touch is quite different then from the experience of seeing. It's only the mind which welds them together into an apparently integral whole, and then calls that thing a mountain, a man, a tree, whatever. Can we trust that mind, which has been conditioned with all sorts of funny ideas, with all sorts of strange ways of looking at the world? Can we trust the interpretations of the mind? Well, experience suggests that that would be unwise, particularly when talking about these fundamental experiences, we see that, as I said just now, the sense fields do not overlap, and we can only actually experience one thing at a time. So anything beyond that becomes synthesis, or, if you prefer, generalization from individual experiences, and that generalization will not be valid in all cases, even if it is valid in some. So it's certainly not the ultimate truth which we seek. We have to set it on one side. So the ultimate truth of experience lies in the experiencing of seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, and of course thinking. Thinking in the sense that thinking is certainly a real experience. Make no mistake about that, it's a real experience. There are such things as ideas. There is such a thing as thinking and mentation generally. But the things thought about are very likely to be non-existent in the ultimate sense. They are likely to be conventional things. Try and give you some idea. Some ultimates of experience. Taking touch as a for instance, you've only got, in the broad sense, three things you can be aware of. Hardness or softness? Heat or cold? And movement, change. So any experience of touch is composed of those things. If you then consider, those are three of the four components of materiality. There are certain derived components of materiality as well. Without getting too technical, one of those is, or two of those, is Itipawa and Pumbawa, which is the mark of the female and the mark of the male. And to try and illustrate what I mean, I might tell you about a doctor who, this was quite some time ago when GPs were really the family doctor, they'd often trained very well, and this particular man had taken on an assistant and was trying to teach him how to recognize bones, the different bones in the skeleton. And so the student had duly learnt off all the bones, their shapes, their sizes, that sort of thing, so that he could recognize them quite easily by sight. The doctor then decided to point out that really this wasn't quite sufficient, and got his student to hand him a number of bones, one after the other, taken from different skeletons, some male, some female, and with his eyes blindfolded, he identified the bones as coming from a male skeleton or a female skeleton, and of course precisely which bone it was, and the student was absolutely nonplussed as to how this was possible. It was only with great difficulty, he felt, that one could tell the difference, and it certainly wasn't obvious at all. The doctor pointed out that female bones were constructed slightly differently, they felt slightly different from male bones. That subtle difference is itipawa, the mark of the female, or indeed the mark of the male. Often you can look at a person in the distance and you know straight away whether that person is male or female. How? There's a certain mark, one of the derived material qualities. There are a whole lot more, there's 23 more in fact, which I don't propose to bore you with at the moment, but these are ultimate experiences. These are things beyond which you can't really reduce human experience any further. Though there we're talking about the physical side of things, of course, again, obviously, as experienced by an individual. But of course, there are many mental factors. Indeed, Buddhism conveniently divides the mind up into 52 functions, or mental factors as they're sometimes called, a few of which are craving, hatred, metta, lightness of mind, sloth, which is really heaviness of mind, and again one could go on. These are ultimates of experience, points of experience beyond which you cannot really go. So, in doing this, one gets down to the fundamental aspects of experience, that which we know to be a fact, that which we know to be true. And you can see that at that level, we're not in any way talking about men, mountains and trees, but we're talking about what you could perhaps call root experiences. We're talking about ultimate truth as opposed to conventional truth. And it's not possible, or it is possible, but it's not wise, to mix the two. For instance, you might be talking to somebody, having really quite a ding-dong argument and thoroughly enjoying it, and then that person might cop out by saying, oh well, in the last analysis it's all craving and hatred, or it's all individual chunks of experience. You've only got seeing on the one hand, visible object. The whole basis for the argument might be destroyed because it probably rested on whether Phyllis had dyed her hair a different colour this week or not, which is something quite different from the ultimate. That's conventional truth. And I've seen people mix the levels up like that, often in much more serious ways, by discussing on a conventional level to suddenly pull in the ultimate, which isn't a valid point for discussion, or conversely, discussing Tama, discussing the teaching on an ultimate level, and suddenly to bring in I and me and mine, which are conventional truths and not ultimately existent. And so the mixing up of the levels can cause great confusion. Indeed, it is a sign of confusion. In Abhidhamma, the higher teaching, there is something called the classification of panyati, or concepts. All concepts, all ideas, if you like, can be divided up into different types depending upon how they're employed. And again, without getting into the details, let me just give you one illustration. One kind of concept is called the naming of something which does exist by something which does not exist. That sounds all horribly complicated, but let me give you an example. You might refer to a man's anger or a man's hatred. Now, hatred is an ultimate of experience, and it does exist. No question. A man, on the other hand, is a conventional truth, and at the ultimate level, does not exist. So you're naming something which does exist, hatred, by something which does not exist, at the ultimate level, a man. So a man's anger, or a man's hatred, is the naming of something that does exist by something that does not exist. And whilst that might sound horribly abstruse, it is one very fine way of distinguishing for yourselves the difference between ultimate and conventional. It's a very fine way of avoiding that potential confusion that can arise from mixing up these two. Another area, of course, is self and non-self. Conventionally, I don't think any of us have a particular problem with self. We talk about myself and yourself. We talk about people as though they exist as selves, and it causes little or no major problems, we hope anyway. However, when we then come across the concept of no self, or anatta, as it is in Buddhism, then indeed it begins to get peculiarly problematic, because we say things like, well, if rebirth is true, then the self dies and the self is reborn, but there is no self, so what is it that's reborn? Mixing the levels. If one stays at the ultimate level, there's no problem. If one stays at the conventional level, there's no problem. Also, one finds meditation reports vary dramatically. Some mix up, mix up conventional and ultimate truth enormously. Some people talk of my mindfulness. Oh dear. So many people wince when I said that. But mindfulness is an ultimate of experience. It certainly does exist. My implies a self, of course. So we're talking then about a conventional truth, and the two terms don't really go together in that sense. My progress. Perhaps a little better, but because progress is conventional truth as well, but still tending to keep one fairly and squarely stuck in conventional truth, and therefore lacking the penetration of analysis which is necessary to get to the real ultimate state of affairs. So a bad meditation report, if I can use the term, is one which tends to be full of I and me and mine, and the more accurate report tends to omit, quite naturally, without trying to do so, tends to omit those particular terms. It tends to say things like, there was mindfulness present, then there was an enormous noise, and fright arose, and then fear arose, based on the natural bodily fright. Then thinking arose, and then I got depressed. But it's much better, if you see what I mean. So then, when we are dealing with the ultimate, you have to say that at that level, there are no men, there are no mountains, and there are no trees. We've come some way along the path by this time. Really, all that can be said to exist is the ultimates of experience and the three marks of conditioned phenomena. Everything's seen as unsatisfactory in one way or another. All things are seen as interdependent, and also, of course, as transient. Everything's seen to be relative. Indeed, this kind of analysis based on individual experience is very much concerned with the qualitative analysis rather than quantitative. By that I mean, it's not a question of how much is there, but what type of thing is there. For example, take hatred, just as a convenient one. Hatred can be present in the mind. Now, that hatred may manifest as a minor irritability, hardly worth mentioning, one might think, to a full-blown raging hatred which obscures one's vision totally and keeps one almost static in one's chair with tension and rage. So, all we're really interested in, from the qualitative point of view, is whether or not hatred is there, not how much of it. Whereas Western science is very much a question of weighing things, measuring things, seeing how much there is of this, how much there is of that, and trying to get a quantitative analysis. The Buddhist way, indeed most Oriental ways, aren't concerned with quantity, they're concerned with quality. Indeed, they are very much concerned with the quality of life. And the quality of life is not improved by increasing the quantity of money, houses, possessions, cars, and all the rest. A bit of a digression perhaps, but it all does fit. So at this ultimate level then, we see those three marks, we see the ultimates of experience, and we realize very clearly that it's all relative. Because it's experienced as unsatisfactory, there is ultimately a turning away from all of this discrete, individual, unsatisfactory, transient experience. The mind refuses to play the game anymore. It turns away to that which really has no name. We could call it the beyond, we could call it nirvana, we can call it a number of things, but essentially it is the nameless. It's beyond relative, it's beyond ultimate, it's beyond all truth. It is, if you like, total realization that what we have thought of as truth is but purely a relative term and has nothing to do with this beyond, this absolute. There's a total realization of the inaccuracy of all concepts, of all ideas, of all dualistic experience. And with that, everything falls into place. There's no more confusion of any sort. And we can say that, once again, men are men, mountains are mountains, and trees are trees, but no one is confused by the terms. We've gone quite beyond truth of any kind, whether it's conventional or whether it's ultimate. Thank you.